This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Siviso. The soil-transmitted helminths, or better known as worms to you and I, which include roundworms, whipworms and even hookworms, are among the most common causes of infection in people who live in the developing world. WHO clinical effectiveness of healthcare intervention studies indicate that if the prevalence of soil-transmitted helminths is 50% or more, deworming leads to significant extra gains in weight, height, mid-upper arm circumference and skin fold thickness. The report concluded that routine deworming of all children in areas with high rates of infection, whether they're shown to have intestinal worms or not, is not, on average, beneficial to kids, and this was found in the recent Cochrane review. It has sort of sparked a debate among scientists concerning the effectiveness of mass deworming programs for improving childhood outcomes. And we have Professor Yvonne Ailien Lim. She's from the Department of Parasitology from the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, to help us understand why the Cochrane review has sort of gone against the WHO clinical effectiveness of healthcare as far as deworming is concerned. I'm sure you and I know we were at some stage dewormed, and you know, till this day when I'm hungry all the time, my mum tells me I really should be deworming. We'll find out more. Welcome to the show, Professor. How are you today?
Thank you, Mira. Thank you for having me here.
You're most welcome. Can you just go through with us what the Cochrane review is before we even begin?
Okay, just to highlight a few things about the Cochrane review for our listeners. It's a review that examined 45 randomized social control trials, and this was coming from 23 countries in Asia and also in Africa. And their conclusion was that they find that mass deworming program did not benefit in terms of average nutritional status, hemoglobin, cognitive, and also school performance or death. Now, this phrase or this conclusion actually has ruffled many feathers. Mm-hmm. And so why is it so? So the controversial aspect of this is that in looking at the effects of deworming and using outcomes as cognitive development, growth development, it's not easy to look at it over a short period of time. Usually you need to do this at a longer period, and most of the studies that they've included is within the range of about 1 to 2 years. And maybe this may not be enough to see the positive effect. So that's one thing, is the duration of the studies that were involved. Secondly, what has happened in the studies that were included, they have sort of pooled the children that were infected and those that were not infected to see this outcome together as a big pool. So they've combined this data, and that has sort of diluted the effects of those that were treated because of helming and had some differences. They were diluted with the effects of those that didn't have the infection.
Okay. So these are, I mean, one of the things I was reading, it's a clinical study as opposed to an observational study.
Yes.
What is the difference?
So the other aspect or the other limitation was not to include the observational studies and also some case studies that we have seen in a clinical setup. So randomized control trials, so you have groups that you actually give the treatment and groups that you do not give the treatment. But within that as well, they would have subdivided those that have the infection and those that without the infection. Observational is something that we do in the community. We go out into the community to see, and some of these people may not have any clinical manifestations. They're basically asymptomatic. And when we go to the field, we know that these are high-risk areas. We basically will treat them, and then we'll observe that after treatment whether there is any reduction in intensity, reduction in their prevalence rates. So I think that is still very useful. Certain communities, we cannot have a case control because that community may be 90% of them that has the infection. To have a control within the community is a bit difficult to do. So they will come under what we observe in the field.
So the Cochrane Review now is saying that is questioning the effectiveness of mass deworming programs to improve childhood outcomes. So what are the guidelines here in Malaysia? Do we have a mass deworming program?
Yes, we do. And we are following very closely what WHO has, like what you have highlighted just now. If the prevalence is 20%, we actually deworm once a year, and 50% is twice a year. Now, historically, helminthic infections in Malaysia were very high before the 1970s. And in 1974, we actually have a national worm control program by the Ministry of Health. Subsequently, in the 80s, these programs have been sort of downsized because we have seen that the effectiveness of this deworming program, and it has downscaled probably till about from more than 50% to 5%. So it's quite a significant decline. So currently what they have is that all government clinics do provide deworming treatment to any children that come. Yeah, and at the same time, they also have deworming programs in schools. So I actually have some data from the Ministry of Health. Okay, in 2013, they have actually identified 9,000 children in Peninsula Malaysia that were having the worms in their body, and they actually dewormed about 270,000 children. So this is the data from Ministry of Health. So they have these programs, but probably in areas where are high-risk areas.
Which are?
Which are generally in the rural areas or peri-suburban areas.
Yeah. Where hygiene
where
is
hygiene
not...
Where hygiene is really poor, inadequate sanitation.
Okay.
And, yeah.
And when we talk about these worms, what are we dealing with? Because you've brought in some worms for me to have a look. And I have to say, the roundworm looks scary. I mean, it's big. You always think of worms as very tiny little things. But the roundworm is big. Which one is most common in Malaysia?
So we actually have three types. Most commonly, we have the roundworm, the weepworm, and the hookworm. Mm-hmm. So the highest are either the roundworm or the weepworm. Yeah.
Okay, so those are the two.
Most common. We do have hookworm as well, but to a lesser extent.
Okay, and so how detrimental can they be if they get into your system?
So like for roundworm, because they are huge, they basically look like a little bit thicker than the spaghetti that we have.
Yep.
So if you have many of them in your intestines, they can cause intestinal blockage or obstruction. Yeah. And sometimes if infection is really high, they actually moved out of the intestine and go to other places of your body. So that is very severe. But otherwise, they also cause malabsorption, malnourishment. They actually compete with the human body for certain vitamins and nutrients.
Like parasites.
Yeah, they are parasites.
Parasites, yeah. Okay. I remember, we were told always to wear shoes or slippers when we played outside, you know, so that we don't get worms.
Yes.
And and how would you contract a roundworm?
Okay, a roundworm is actually through the ingestion of the egg.
Okay.
So for weepworm as well, ingestion of the eggs. And they are called soil transmitted for certain reasons. Because in their life cycle, they need to be in the soil. So an infected person will actually excrete this parasite in their feces. So what we get in the feces is the eggs. So the feces needs to contaminate the soil. And in a very poor setup, where kids normally play with the soil, they get their hands dirty. And if they don't wash it properly, they start feeding themselves with their soiled hands. So that's how they get the transmission. So for the ones that, for hookworm, that's the one that where wearing shoes are important.
Yep.
Because they get into human body through our skin penetration. And again, because they're in the soil, so the most highly chance is from our feet. So the skin between our toes and our sole. So that's why it's very important to wear shoes.
Of course. Yes. And you would mistake the roundworm, I mean, besides the colour, of course, mm-hmm. with earthworms.
Yes. usually when I teach my students, I'll tell them that, you know, we are more... We know more about earthworm, but earthworm, they are segmented. If you look carefully, they have actually lines on their body. Mm-hmm. But for a roundworm, it's basically creamy in colour.
Yep.
Yeah, but the size is almost there.
Okay, also. And roundworms are usually red earthworms are usually
yes.
red in colour.
Yes.
So
yes.
you can tell the difference.
Yes.
But do you think we still have that problem here in the urban setting?
In the urban setting, not quite. Unless we are talking about the urban poor communities. So, like communities where they have squatter areas, foreign workers. So we do see that there is a study that we are doing now. So it's about 50% or a bit more. But these are high-risk group communities. But in the general population in the urban setup, it's very low. It's probably less than 1%. 0.5 or less than that.
So we've done very well then.
Yes, okay. We have.
But as adults, do you still think we need to deworm?
If you're not in a high-risk area, and if, let's say, your hygiene practices are good, you don't come in contact with soil that you believe is contaminated, you do not really need to deworm on a regular basis. Unless there is a justification to do so, so there's some clinical signs, you feel that there is anemia, anemic, because for hookworm, you actually feel that you look pale and you feel lethargic. Yeah. So if there are certain signs like this, then yes. But in high-risk communities, we actually recommend a periodic deworming. Yeah. So to control worm, basically, it's important to first to treat, because to treat, then to immediately reduce the infection. Second is health education, because it's so much associated with sanitation. Education is very important to help people to change their practices that are encouraging this transmission. So, so that is to prevent... to control the infection. And the third thing is also to provide facilities. When we provide facilities, I might state here that JAKUA is the Department of Orang Asli Development and also the Ministry of Health. They are doing a lot of good work for the Orang Asli community. But there are certain gaps that I think we'll need to fill up. So like the Orang Asli community, where infections are very high, they're provided with toilets, they're provided with water supply, electricity and all. But there are times whereby the proper usage of these facilities may not be there. But we have to bear in mind that whatever facilities that we are providing, we need to engage the community, because we need to know if they want to solve this problem, what's the best way that they can be receptive towards. So for example, like the toilets that we build, generally the Orang Asli would prefer toilets that are detached from the house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But most often we have provided toilets that are within the house,
right,
like what we have in our urban setup, which is good. We are trying to introduce them development, but we have to be sensitive to what they actually would like.
Yes, you know? I always argue. They may not want development.
Yeah.
We sort of force it down their throats. They're quite happy.
They want development, but they also have a certain perception or concept. They have concept of about cleanliness and hygiene as well.
Okay, I want to know more about that. We're discussing mass deworming programs with Professor Yvonne Ailian Lim from University of Malaya. We are discussing this because there was a Cochrane review that sparked a debate among scientists concerning the effectiveness of mass deworming programs to improve childhood outcomes. I think Malaysia is a perfect example of how successful it has been. And... I would, in that case, I wouldn't agree with the Cochrane review. I mean, would you agree with it, Professor?
I would take it with very cautiously.
Yeah.
Because the consequences of this review is actually tremendous. There are a lot of big foundations and companies that are basically funding mass deworming in countries that are really in need. And so we cannot generalize these findings to every community.
Right. Yeah. So up next, we'll find out more about the hygiene practices of the Orang Asli community and what they really want. And, you know, coming back to the Cochrane review, they're saying that there's a lack of evidence of benefit. Not that there's evidence of lack of benefit. What is that? There's a critical distinction in what that really means. Up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sevisodi. We're discussing mass deworming programs on our health show today. Professor Yvonne Ailian Lim from the Department of Parasitology, Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, in the studio with us, helping us understand mass deworming programs here in Malaysia as well as opposed to across abroad. Rural communities are usually affected by this more than urban communities, only because of sanitation, hygiene practices, our lifestyle, water supply. I think all of that plays a huge difference. But as Professor earlier mentioned, we have a problem with the urban slums as well here. And we still have pockets of people of high-risk groups that need help as far as deworming is concerned. And you have worked very much with the Orang Asli community. You were talking about their hygiene practices. What is it?
Okay. So like I mentioned just now, the Orang Asli, they have their certain perception of what cleanliness is, what hygiene is. So let us look back at their traditional lifestyle. So most of the time they're living very near a river, and that's where they get their water supply. And in terms of sanitation, some of them may be more comfortable to actually defecate in the river. And to them, the river water is a cleansing tool. It's a very natural kind of a setup. When we build the toilets, for us, it's the most hygienic thing to have. You have the toilet bowls. And when we defecate, we actually flush them down with water. Now, in this community, sometimes the water supply is not continuous. Yeah, and so sometimes we get complaints whereby that it's very dirty. They know it's dirty because they may not have the ample water supply to basically flush it down every time. Yeah, and they also have this concept that toilets needs to be built outside of the house. Again, I think I appreciate that sort of cleanliness understanding, that they do not want to see the toilet from their within their house. So it's okay to have the toilets built next to, but the door needs to be outside.
Okay.
Somewhere that you can't see.
In a way, it's a hygiene practice,
yes,
actually.
Yes,
makes sense, doesn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
So are we catering to that?
So I think more effort can be done to really understand this, of how we can actually tweak whatever we have right now. So the government is actually doing a lot in building for them houses, in resettling them into communities. But we need to engage the local people to see whether what we are proposing here, is it really suitable, or there may be some adjustments that need to be made. So getting them on board, I think, is really important.
And that's education and awareness.
Yes, yes.
Who's monitoring these programs?
So in terms of deworming, it will be the Ministry of Health. Yeah. So previously, before 2012, the health aspect has been, it's under the Department of Orang Asli. But since 2012, the Ministry of Health has taken over the health aspect of the Orang Asli.
We've spoken about how worms can cause anemia and malnourishment, but are there any physical manifestations?
Yes. So, and helminth infections can be chronic. they can live in your body. Let's say for roundworm, it could be 1 to 2 years. Whipworm as well. Hookworm can be as long as 10 years to 18 years. Yeah, so we are talking about chronic infections here. So because of the malnourishment, so you have gradually you have retardation in growth. So you have stunting, you have underweight. So this is something that we can see physically. Yeah. So when we go to the community, you can see even the quality of their hair. You can see that's malnourished. Mm-hmm. Yeah. From the eyes, the
so the minute you walk in, you know that they have a worm
extension.
Problem.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And they're open to deworming?
Yes, they are. Actually, when we go in, they do want medication. They're very open. Generally, they are. But they're very shy people. So when we go in, we actually take quite a bit of time to get to know them rather than just straight away to do what we're supposed to do. We make friends with them. Yeah.
Would you say the programs are a success?
Yes and no. There are a certain level of success. Efforts are being made. I think if we were to make them better, we really have to sort of do it collectively together with the community, not just with selected representation of the community, but as a whole. Yeah.
So we're focusing on high-risk communities as mm-hmm. far as deworming program is concerned in the country. Not as much a mass deworming program anymore.
Yeah, so they do pockets. Have it in schools. Yeah, pockets.
Okay.
Yeah.
And for how long do you deworm your child?
Basically, the drug is effective for 6 months. But if there's no necessity of it, you don't really have to deworm.
Okay, and what do we look out for to decide whether it is necessary or not?
So sometimes, kids may come complaining about appetite, not wanting to eat, very pale. You can see there's some malnutrition, but there could be other causes as well. Yeah, the thing is that sometimes people just deworm because generally, the medication, there's no side effect and it's effective. So, like the Cochrane review, they are suggesting that we actually diagnose before we deworm. But in certain setups, it will be more expensive to actually screen every individual because these countries may not even have the tools to diagnose. Yeah. So it will be easier actually to just mass deworm.
Yeah. Okay. So... Funny you said lack of appetite. My mum always said I was always hungry and so she said I had worms. Is there a possibility that you'd always be hungry as well?
Yes, yeah, because the parasite in you is also helping
itself with the nutrition.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. How do factors like timing and severity of the infection sort of influence the effect of these worms as far as allergies are concerned? Because I understand there's a link with allergies as well.
Yes. So now there are more and more studies that are indicating that there is an inverse association between helminthic infections and allergy and asthma. So this is because of our immune system. So the helminths are triggering Th2, one arm of the immune system, whereas the allergy and asthma is triggering another arm of the immune system. So because of the helminths, it's going to sort of tilt the balance of these two. And studies have found that when you have helminthic infections, chances is that you have lesser problems with asthma and allergy. And you were talking about in terms of timing, in terms of intensity. So we have found that infections that are chronic, long-lasting, and where it's more intense would actually be more, in a way, protective because it does suppress
the immune system?
Suppress the immune system that triggers allergy.
Okay. So you have lesser allergies if you do have worms.
Yeah.
So there are some benefits.
There are some benefits.
No, but not. We don't want to look at it that way.
Yes. Okay. We'll talk about it another day.
Of course. And if you are, immunologically you're compromised, your immune system is compromised, how will a parasite like this affect you?
So if you're immunocompromised, chances is that sometimes the worms or the helminths will get out of the intestines because usually they are contained in our intestine, but they can go to other organs. and they can affect on our systemic function.
Okay. Yeah. So it triggers the immune system?
Yes, it does, but it depends on where it goes as well. Yeah, so you get hyperinfection, you get disseminated infections.
What are they? Examples?
So basically, there's another worm that's called strongyloides. So this is a trait worm. And it's very common that if we find this in the HIV individuals, we will be a bit more cautious in treating this infection, because sometimes they can really multiply.
Outside of the intestine?
Yeah, yeah. And they can move out of the intestine. Yeah.
Okay. Mm. So, all right. So the immune system triggers the the character.
Yeah,
they become
a bit more aggressive.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a way of eradicating these worms?
Well, treatment is still the way to go. So if you know of someone that's having this infection, you have to treat them. And coupled with good health education. Okay, one thing about health education, coming back to the orang asli, and knowing that these infections are so much associated with poverty, we cannot just give them pamphlets with the do's and don'ts. We have to make it experiential. What I mean by this is that, you know, Mira, when I came in and show you that the worms, mm-hmm. it does have an impression.
It does.
Yeah.
And a few other people in the office.
Yeah, that's right. And that sort of impression has to be long-lasting for them to prevent themselves from getting it. The other thing about health education is that we tend to forget that when we are dealing with a poor community, they may not have the means to have the solution. Like we say that you need to wear shoes, you need to wear slippers.
And we take it for granted.
Yes. They prefer to use their money to buy rice than to get a pair of shoes. This is survival. So I think we need to look at that aspect, that we need to provide them simple things like this as well in order to make it very effective. Yeah. And of course, the facilities, like I said just now, we need to relook how we can fill the gaps. Currently, the facilities are there, but probably it's not being optimally used. So we need to engage the community to know why, so that we have to tweak the programs that we have.
Makes you think how we just take life for granted in the city, honestly.
Yes, that's right.
Simple thing like slippers and shoes, you know, they have to decide on whether what to invest in, really.
Yeah. I think in that sense, you know, everybody can chip in. We can have even the established pharmaceutical companies. You see, the deworming drugs in the market, like Zantel, is about 6 ringgit currently for one dosage, and a dosage of 2 tablets of 200 milligram. It may seem negligible for us, but to these communities, it's substantial. Yeah. So,
but doesn't Ministry of Health foot these bills?
Yeah, they do provide.
And for how long will you need to deworm? You said every 6 months.
Every 6 months.
For a community that's high risk, how long do the children have to be on this program?
Okay. The actual scene is like this. We can be deworming them. But in certain communities, we find that by the second month, they get reinfected again. By 6 months, it's back to the original, you know, 80%, 90%.
Right.
So it needs to be a continuous effort. Ministry of Health is doing it. But I think it's good to have programs whereby we can adopt certain communities so that, you know, fundings are we channel fundings continuously to these communities. And so make it affordable and accessible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as you said, I mean, it's not really, it's not all about the medication.
Yes.
If they don't understand, then they will continue to get infected.
Yes, yes. I'd like to share with you the health education that one of our students has developed. So what we did was that we had comic books, we had puppet shows, we had... we actually engaged the kids to bring back these messages back to their parents, back to their siblings. We actually train them as agent of change. So this program was very successful. We did it in Pahang, and we realized that when you actually couple deworming programs with effective health education, it really reduces it by 70%. Yeah. But there's lots of effort to do this, but I think it's not impossible. And the kids really enjoyed it. We actually have goodie bags for everybody.
Right.
Yeah. So
how many children do you think are affected or are from these high-risk communities in the country?
In the high-risk community, it can be as high as 90% over. Yeah.
Of the children in the high-risk communities.
High-risk communities, okay. Yes.
So is there anything, any other positives of the Cochrane Review? Besides, of course, finding a link with asthma and allergies. I know there is a debate about how they are discouraging mass deworming programs. But any other benefits from the Cochrane Review or, you know, gaps, for an example?
I think the Cochrane Review has, in a way, opened a can of worms.
Literally.
Yeah. And
I mean, I didn't think in this day and age I'd be speaking about deworming, honestly. But you're right. I mean, it's opened up discussions as well.
Yes. So I think that's a positive thing. Yeah. I mean, that's a problem here. And I think people are realizing that we don't have enough data to back up what we are saying. The data is not robust enough for us to make real good conclusion that can be generalized. I think the what's positive about it is that it has created a kind of energy for discussion and for us to let's lay things on the table and let's see how we can move on from here. In a more harmonized way. Yeah. So I see that from that positive point. And maybe it's true that for certain communities, mass deworming may not be needed. So we have to be selective. I think it's all about doing things with proper evidence. That we are not doing it this just because it was done in the past. We need to constantly question whether, you know, what we are doing, it's okay or needs to be tweaked or, you know, maybe it's not needed. So, I mean, it has helped us to be more cautious. Yeah, but I'm not saying that deworming is not good. It is still applicable in many communities of high risk.
Your message to the urban community?
So to the urban community, definitely, I think we are generally of higher, we have higher hygiene practices, but sometimes we may be a bit contented, complacent about our practices. So do be careful when we are in areas whereby there may be soil that are contaminated so that you really wash your hands properly because the eggs of these worms are very, very minute.
But how will we know we're in areas which are, you know, contaminated?
Yes. So high-risk areas that I was telling you, areas that slum areas where we have, generally in the urban setup, It's okay, but like I mentioned, there are pockets of communities. When we are because nowadays we do travel a lot,
yeah.
So when we are traveling, even overseas, it's not just here. We need to be mindful, and I think when we travel nowadays, we are quite adventurous about countries that we travel to.
Yeah.
Yes.
So watch out for what. Third world countries, developing countries.
Yes, where sanitation, proper sanitation is not there. You can sense the low hygiene practices. So these will be areas that you need to watch out so that you keep your practices of high standards.
Even as adults.
Yes.
Even as adults. Thank you very much for joining us today. Okay. Professor Yvonne Eileen Lim, Department of Parasitology, from the Faculty of Medicine, University of Malaya, talking to us about mass deworming programs on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.